Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is the Wizard of Odds, Michael Shackelford. Shaq co-hosted this show for about a year and has been a guest numerous times. Michael Shackelford, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
All serious blackjack players know that for basic strategy players, the more decks you have, the worse the odds. But why? That's the subject of some research you undertook recently. Tell us about this.
Yes, absolutely. One of the most frequent questions I get about blackjack is, why do the number of decks matter to the house edge if I'm not counting cards? And with all of the high-level blackjack texts that I have, I could not find a good treatment of why this is so. Peter Griffin touches on it in his book, The Theory of Blackjack, but shall we say he doesn't dig very deep into it. So I felt that this was kind of a calling of mine to answer this question. So that is what I set about and tried to do. So would you like to hear about how I did it?
Nah, we just came on. We don't want to hear anything about it.
Well, you know, I didn't want to just sit here rambling on for 10 minutes.
Good, of course we do. What did you find out?
Okay, so, well, the way I, okay, well, to jump to the end, let me pull this up here. Here's a breakdown of the reasons that fewer decks are beneficial to the player. The biggest reason is that the player has the freedom of choice to stand on stiff totals of 12 to 16, and the dealer does not. Now, why is that beneficial? It's because there is a lot more busting in single deck than, say, eight decks, and this is true for both sides. But the freedom of choice to stand on a stiff total is much more beneficial in a single deck game because it saves you from a lot more busting than in an eight deck game. So of the altogether, depending upon the rules, the house edge is about 0.56% less in a single deck game compared to an eight deck game. And of that 0.56% difference, standing on stiff totals makes up 0.433% of it. So the vast majority of it is, again, that freedom of choice to stand on stiff totals. Now, you might ask, why is there more busting in a single deck game? And all of this comes down to the effect of removal. And if in a single deck game, whenever you bust, you do it because you're hitting a total between 12 and 16. And if either side has a total in that range, it's more likely to be composed of small cards than big cards. And so when you take just a couple of small cards out of a single deck game, that makes the rest of the deck richer in tens and makes busting just all that more likely. So are you with me so far?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay, so the number two reason is doubling down. And that accounts for 0.273% of that difference. And why is doubling down more powerful in a single deck game? It's much the same reason that if the player is doubling, it's probably on a total of 10 or 11, and that must be composed of two cards. So if you have two cards that add up to 10 or 11, those are definitely going to be small to medium cards, making the rest of the deck or the shoe richer in tens. And those tens are going to help you with a double down. So the richer those remaining cards are in tens, the more powerful that double down is. So it doesn't make much difference if you remove two small cards from an eight deck shoe, but it makes a significant difference in a single deck game. So the doubling is a strong number two reason. And way behind that is blackjacks paying 3-2. There are more blackjacks in a single deck game. And again, it comes down to that effect of removal. If your first card is, say, an ace, then you've removed, then the rest of that deck in a single deck game, you've got 16 tens and 51 total cards. So it increases that probability of getting a 10 on, as the second card getting a blackjack. Same thing with getting it if your first card is a 10. The rest of the deck is more ace rich after you just remove one 10 from a single deck game. And in an eight deck game, that effective removal is quite small. And as you know, a winning blackjack pays 3-2 to the player, but he only loses even money if the dealer gets that blackjack. So more blackjacks benefits the player. However, of that 0.563% total benefit, the blackjacks only make up 0.6% of it, so not very much. And there are a couple things that work against the player in a single deck game. Those are splitting. There is a lot more splitting going on in an eight deck game. For example, let's say that the first card the player gets is an eight. In a single deck game, there's only three eights left in the 51 cards, making the probability of getting a pair 1 in 17, where it's almost 1 in 13 in an eight deck game. So, the fewer splitting opportunities costs the player 0.125%. in a single deck game. And finally, there's the dealer positional advantage. Another question I often get about blackjack from recreational players is, why is there a house advantage in blackjack at all? Why don't I just copy what the dealer does, and shouldn't I make money because I'm getting 3-2 on my blackjacks? And the reason is because the dealer has a positional advantage in that if both sides bust, the player loses. So, again, there is more busting going on in a single deck game. And if both sides bust, then the dealer wins. So that positional advantage benefits the dealer more in a single deck game. So that costs the player 0.79%. So when you add up all these positives and negatives that I just said, the total, benefit the total benefit in a single deck game is 0.563%. And this is for a game where the dealer hits a soft 17, double after splitting is allowed, resplitting of aces is allowed, and surrender is not allowed. So that's the executive summary there. I can kind of explain how I did it mathematically if you're interested.
I'm pretty sure that for radio, executive summaries are fine. But were somebody interested in this, you've posted this information. Is that correct?
Yes, I have a rather long article on Wizard of Odds about it. It's in the Blackjack section, obviously. It's titled Why the Number of Decks Matter in Blackjack. So if you go to my site and search for that, you will find my in-depth article all about it, which explains how I, shall we say, it was like peeling an onion, where I just changed one thing at a time in the blackjack. In a blackjack game, and looked at how that one change affected the overall game in both a single deck and an eight deck game.
And we'll put a link directly to that article in the show notes.
Thank you.
Now, you selected a particular set of rules, a reasonable set, but a particular one. Mm-hmm. Had you chosen like 6-5 blackjack instead of 3-2, do you expect your results would have been comparable?
Yes, the benefit would have been a little bit less because of the benefit of blackjacks is much less in a 6-5 game. And again, there are more blackjacks in a single deck game than in an eight deck game. But if a blackjack pays 6-5, it's not really helping you as much as a 3-2 game.
Now,
otherwise, it would all cut the same way.
Would you call this an intellectual curiosity, or is there a practical use for this information?
This is not going to help anybody win any more money, but I like answering the mathematical questions about blackjack. And as a gambling writer, I strive to break new ground wherever I can. And I felt this was a big unanswered question in the world of blackjack. And I spent, the good part of probably 3 weeks trying to answer it. So I'm pretty proud of the work. I'm not sure that many people are going to read it, but it was just a calling of mine to address it.
Well, that's great. It's I thank you for it. Your site is used as a resource for a large number of us, and some of your intellectual meanderings turn into useful information every now and then. And so if that's what makes you tick and you're the wizard, well, so be it.
Well, thank you very much. Those are very kind words.
Let's move on. There was a recent Reversible Royal promotion at the Red Rock. So first of all, tell us what Reversible Royals are and what makes this a good deal.
Okay. I wouldn't classify this as a promotion as it's still going on right now. And so let me explain the difference between a sequential royal and a reversible royal. A sequential royal is a royal flush that is in order in one way only, going from low to high. In other words, 10, jack, queen, king, ace. It doesn't count in any other configuration. Now, a reversible royal counts in either direction, either forwards the way I just said, or it can be backwards going ace, king, queen, jack, 10. So a reversible royal, if you're not making any strategy changes, one in every 60 royal flushes will be in order like that. And the three Red Rock banks that offer a jackpot for this are all reversible, so they pay in both directions.
Okay, so how high are they?
Okay, so there's three banks. There is one bank that is a 5-cent game with a 5-coin bet. That jackpot, when last I checked, was $40,741. And these jackpots are going up very slowly. Maybe it's about $41,000 now. The second bank is also a 5-cent machine, but it is a 10-coin bet to qualify for the jackpot. That jackpot is, when last I checked, $75,489. And finally, there is a 25-cent 5-coin game that has a jackpot of $119,642. When last I checked, and when last I checked was about a week ago.
And that translates to what advantage?
Okay, the first game, the 5-coin, 5-cent game, that is a base game of 6-5 Bonus Poker Deluxe. That has an advantage, or should I say a return, of 105.22%. So I calculate at a speed of 1,000 hands an hour, that is an expected win of $13.05 an hour. The 5-cent 10-coin game, the base game there is 8-5 double bonus, so a little bit of a better game. That has an expected return of 105.27%, almost the same. The hourly there is $26.37. And the 5-coin 25-cent game, that has a lower return of 102.35%, but because you're betting more, the hourly at, again, 1,000 hands per hour is the highest at $29.33. And surprisingly, I don't see a whole lot of people playing this, and perhaps it's not surprisingly, given the huge volatility in it and taxes and just the danger of going into a casino in the first place.
Well, yes. I looked at the promotion a few months ago, and even with it was higher than the $30 an hour then, but it was, you're going to lose about $60,000 a year on the quarter game.
Yep.
Waiting to hit, and you know, obviously somebody else could hit it in the meantime. Most quarter players don't have that kind of a bankroll sitting around.
$60,000 a year. What do you mean a year?
Well, you hit a sequential royal every 60 royals. So if you look at 40,000 hands for one royal, 60 royals is 2.4 million hands, which is going to take you a long time.
Even
the 1,000 hands an hour, that's 2,400 hours, which is more than a year for most people, and
right.
they're gonna
But for the but for the ploppies who are in there playing slot machines, they would still be way better off playing this machine, even if they didn't play it well, than better than playing a slot.
I would almost say that the worst video poker machine is better than the best slot machine, if you don't count advantage plays in slot machines.
Yeah.
I would disagree with that. I have seen bonus poker machines paying 2-for-1 for the for 3-of-a-kind. So every now and then you find a 92% or 91% video poker machine, and it's frequent you'll find slot machines returning more than that. But on
that's
average,
a good point. I've never seen video poker that bad, but you would know better than me.
On average, though, that's a correct statement. Usually video poker returns quite a bit more. All right, let's talk about Morongo. They recently had a promotion, and you told the world about it. So what happened?
Okay, so the Morongo had a promotion for, I believe, their 16th anniversary, where in blackjack, if you got a hard 16 in your initial two cards, they gave you a bonus of $16, regardless of how much you bet. And I calculated that this was worth about $30 an hour, depending upon play speed and what was the bet, the minimum at the table. But it was definitely a good play. And I mentioned this in my forum at Wizard of Vegas. And I understand that some people didn't like that. And I've written about other plays before on my forum and have been vilified for it. Surprisingly, the pushback about Morongo was not so bad. But I make no apologies for that. I think the world would be a better place with open access to truthful information. And while talking about a play may hurt those who already know about it, it also benefits the people that play it that didn't know about it. So I think overall, players make more money when the information is more widely broadcast.
So Wong on BJ21, he also had a policy. He said, you know, if you tell me about it, I am going to write about it. Like, that was his stated policy. So, you know, players should know that if they post something. I think one of the things people objected to in this particular case was the player who first posted about it purposely did not name the casino. And apparently, you know, people were upset that you then Googled around to find out where the promotion was to specifically name the casino. So, but I think the important thing is, you know, you are consistent, and so if players know, look, if you're going to post something there, it is going to get revealed and talked about. So, you know, you're upfront about it, which I think is the most important thing.
Yeah, Wong's policy is my policy, too. If someone writes about a play, you know, they're allowed to, and I will comment about it. And there's a flagging feature on my site, and one time somebody wrote about a play, and in mass a bunch of people flagged that post off the site, and I got kind of angry about it, and dug up the old post and reposted it. Hmm. So, and you know, furthermore, I feel a little bit out of the loop when it comes to advantage plays, and maybe there's good reason for that, but in the past there have been some really good ones at the Tuscany that nobody told me about, and frankly I was maybe a little bit miffed about it. So I like for the recreational advantage player to have access to good plays, and so I'm doing it for them. And if it's at the expense of the few advantage players that are well connected in terms of information, then so be it. I make no apologies.
No, I get that. But sometimes it's at the expense of everybody, including the recreational players, because the promotion gets called off before it ever starts.
That is true. But I think that doesn't happen very much. I think most casinos will grin and bear it when they do a bad promotion, as the Morongo did. They should get due credit for following through on this promotion. And much like the Mohegan Sun, they went through with their promotion. And I think that it's the exception rather than the rule that casinos will call off a promotion early because they get killed on it.
And I do not go with that conclusion. Certainly Morongo in the past has killed promotions early. A lot of casinos, when they finally realize that they're on the wrong side of it big time, they'll make it a 2-hour promotion instead of a 24-hour promotion. But anyway, good. Let's go on.
Well, I'd like to say that that's a fair criticism, and I take it. And I wrote a lot about the Revel You Can't Lose promotion. And I have heard anecdotally that they took out the best machines and they slow paid players in part because of what I wrote about it. So, you know, I accept that for whatever it's worth.
Okay. There's a number of advantage slot machines out there. You've written about some of those in the past. Have you done any such things recently?
No, I'm afraid not. I'm eager to explore another one. I am open to suggestions about the next advantage play slot machine to write about, something like Golden Egypt or Ocean's Magic, where the machine can be left in a positive state by the previous player. And so if anyone has a suggestion for me, I'm all ears. You know how to reach me through my Wizard of Oz site. And but, yeah, I don't have anything to talk about right now. Bob, I'd be interested to know if you are a slot player these days.
I am not.
And why might that be?
I avoid advantage slots simply because I think I'm so well known in casinos. In every casino in Las Vegas and in some other places as well, I'm a known video poker player, apparently feared or respected or some combination, and my plays are watched. Even in video poker, if I find an excellent game in a casino and start playing it, that game is frequently removed quickly. So given the scrutiny that I'm under, if I start playing certain advantage slots, then casinos might, at a minimum, notice who else is looking at those same machines and take action against them. So I would not get any benefit out of this, and other advantage players would be shut out or kicked out. And I don't want the grief for that. So I just stay away. I can still eke out whatever it is that I need out of video poker. And I'm content that way.
Well, that's a nice and unselfish thing that you're doing for the rest of Advantage players. So I think you deserve all due credit for that.
Oh, good. Thank you. I appreciate that. Super Bowl prop bets. For years, you would come on this show and tell us your Super Bowl prop bets. And the rules in professional football have changed. And so there's a whole lot more things like how often teams go for 2 points conversions, or how often they go for it on fourth down, or they get more passing yards now due to different rules in pass interference. And so your database was no longer current. And so using old numbers would have you making a losing play if you were betting on Super Bowl props. So somewhere along the way, you decided that this wasn't a good thing for you to be doing anymore. The reason I'm bringing this up is not, haha, you screwed up, but every advantage player has to keep in mind when to get off a game, when to, when the jig is up, when it isn't such a good play anymore. And so I'm kind of looking to explore that a little bit, is how did you decide when it was no longer a good play again?
Yeah, you summarized it really well. Is I had a really big database that I spent a lot of time in with that I put in every single play of every single game by hand because I couldn't find any other source where I could buy from. And this data went back to the year 2000. But through the years, the rules of football changed and just the way it was played changed. A big change was that they're trying to make football safer so that they are, shall we say, putting restrictions on the defenses to not play so aggressively. And that is causing higher scoring games. Also, field goals. So many of my prop bets were related to field goals. And I was consistently betting the under, like under 3.5 field goals in the whole game was a big one of mine. And field goal kickers are just kicking much longer field goals now than they were, say, 15 years ago. And that's driving up the numbers. So it's not proper to analyze how many field goals are going to be in a game in the year 2020 when you're looking at data from going back as far as 2000. It's not going to give you a good estimate. And granted, all along I was making mental adjustments for this, but it, you know, the bottom line is that while I used to do really well with Super Bowl props, I could just see that I was winning less and less per year, and it didn't help that there were four safeties in a period of 6 years, which is another one of my favorites. But yeah, I basically waved the white flag. I am sick of updating this database with every single game. I am sick of running all over Vegas the 2 weeks before the Super Bowl, shopping around for good bets. I'm, you know, sick of not making much money and in some cases losing. I had some losing years. And meanwhile, I have a friend who does the same thing, but he focuses more on player props, like will Tom Brady score 1.5 passing touchdowns? And he consistently was doing well. And he made me an offer where he said, if you loan me any amount of money for Super Bowl props, I will get to take 60% of it as just a straight loan. And the other 40% is you will be basically piggybacking on my bets. And so that's what I've been doing. And it's as easy as just giving him a bag of money. And he kindly tells me some of his biggest plays before the game. And so, you know, I'm happy to pay someone to do all the running around for me. And this is somebody who I very much respect. He has a degree in statistics from Berkeley. And so it's a win-win situation for both of us.
Yeah, I had a similar deal to that, other than the loaning money part, but on with a guy named Michael Shackelford. And I was on all four of those no safeties. And when you're betting $8,000 to win $1,000 or whatever the numbers were, and it goes against you, you're going to have a losing year. So I was fortunate enough to be on the wrong side of all eight of those bridge jumpers.
Yeah.
So that was no fun.
Yeah, I course, feel your pain right there with you.
Oh, yeah.
And those four safeties had a lot to do with my confidence going way down.
Actually, I want to ask, though, about the databases, because we recently had on there's a new book. Boy, do I have the title right? Is it Sports Betting 2020? Yeah. Yeah. And he was talking about buying databases that I guess he felt were pretty good. Have you investigated those or no? Or you're just sick of it enough that you don't want to bother?
What was the name of it again?
Well, the book, I think, is called Sports Betting 2020. It's the new Huntington Press sports betting book.
I'm definitely going to get that.
And Logan Fields.
I'll know about it.
Logan Fields was the author, and he was on the show, I don't know, 6 weeks ago or something.
Month or so. Yeah.
And
I'm definitely interested. One of my favorite gambling books is Sharp Sports Betting by Stanford Wong, and that's how I got my whole philosophy of sports betting, is having absolutely nothing to do with handicapping and assuming that the market is efficient with the point spread and then betting the exotic stuff. But yeah, I definitely love the math of sports betting, and as soon as this interview is over, I'm going to order that book.
Yeah, his approach is exactly what you're talking about. He buys databases, mines the data, and looks for those, you know, those good bets.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, okay, moving on. Too. When you were co-host of this show in 2012,
mm-hmm.
during the election season, you regularly reported on how the various betting markets were on the presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of our sponsors is Predicted.org, which allows you to do similar on a smaller deal. Were you involved in the 2020 elections in the betting way, and how did that go?
Oh, yes. I've been involved with every presidential election betting wise since, Clinton Dole. And, was it Dole? No, it was, yeah, it was. So, yes. So I definitely was involved. I was still stinging from 2016 where I had a lot of money on Hillary Clinton. And I laid a lot on her, and we know what happened there, but I was unfazed 4 years later. I had finished licking my wounds, and early this year, I was betting a lot on Trump, and I was betting it all through five dimes, and, or some of it was individually against people, and I would say just like a couple weeks before the election, I started to have a lot of doubts. I mean, Biden was just polling really well nationwide. He was polling 8 to 10 points ahead of Trump as compared to Hillary Clinton, who was, I think, only polling about 6 points ahead. And so many of these states are settled by extremely small margins that just getting an extra 2% can swing a whole election. And I did a lot of math, and I wrote a big newsletter about this. But at the end of the day, I thought that Biden had about a 75-80% chance of winning, and I only had to lay about 180 to 200 on him. So it just looked like a great value. And, you know, granted, the mail-in ballots was a huge red flag, and it was or shall we say, not a huge red flag, just a something that hadn't been done before, you know, something that was difficult to analyze. And I also knew that the whole thing might come down to the courts. And I thought Trump probably would have an advantage in the courts. But if we assume those things roughly canceled each other out, I thought that like I said, Biden was the better value. And just, shall we say, like a month before the election, Trump was still polling pretty well, but his polling numbers just collapsed in the last month. And I think we know why. We don't need to get into that. And so another thing that happened is Five Dimes, in an internet sportsbook out of Costa Rica, they decided in September, October that they were going to get out of the U.S. market. And with every bet that was still standing, including lots of futures bets, they refunded them. And a lot of people were really angry about this because they had futures bets that had gone up in equity. But I had about $20,000 in Trump bets with them. And when they refunded them, they were kind of angry about it. But when I had all this basically cash back and looking for people to bet on Trump with, you know, I wasn't able to get enough of it down. And then, like I said, about 1 to 2 weeks before the election, I basically figured that maybe I made a mistake. And so I started betting big the other way. And I was betting, you know, as much money as I could to mitigate all my individual bets against friends on Trump. So I had to lay anywhere from 180 to 200 on Biden. So I was in a position on election day where I would make a small amount if Biden won and lose a lot if Trump won. So I was, very carefully watching the election night coverage there. So, yeah, that is my story on that.
Very good.
Why this is the first election where I basically had bets on both sides and had a change of heart.
All right. We are going to take a brief commercial break, and then we're going to get back and ask Shaq about when he was playing Jeopardy with James Holzhauer. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In December, the promotion of the month is half price almost everything between using your points from December 14th to 30th. This includes restaurants, bars, movies, gift shops, spas, salons, bingos, full details at the club. You don't earn the points in December. Just have them uncashed and available, and they count. On Christmas Day, the hot seat promotion, where $100 in free play goes to a player every 3 minutes starting at 8 a.m. The normal semester of free video poker classes starting in January or February has been canceled due to COVID concerns. We're optimistic that we'll be able to continue the class semester in September of 2021. Unpredicted.org is a market where you can place small bets on the occurrence of various political happenings, mostly but not entirely in the United States. Gamblers with an edge listeners receive a one-time offer of a deposit match up to $20 at predicted.org/promo/edge. You must play the money through once and cannot withdraw it for 30 days. VideoPoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Wheel Poker with Quick Quads. This is a 7 coins per light game, which is 1 extra for the wheel and 1 extra for Quick Quads. The wheel spin averages 157.5 coins, and you get it for every quad and every quick quad. The double-double version at the South Point returns some 99.8% and is available for triple play and five-play quarters. When I'm teaching the classes again, you can get the strategy there, or if you go on the wizardofodds.com on Video Poker Strategy Analyzer, it allows you to look at that and get a good strategy for free quickly. Let's go back to Michael Shackelford. I saw a picture of you recently playing Jeopardy, where you were in the champion seat and James Holzhauer was in the non-champion seat. Now, this had to be a fake picture because he was only in the non-champion seat for one game, and that wasn't you that day. So what happened?
Yeah, that picture fooled a lot of people. So what was going on is at the 2019 Global Gaming Expo, the IGT was running some kind of a Jeopardy promotion. And so they got the actual podiums and all that jazz from the Jeopardy set. I think it was an old, you know, podiums and whatnot. And so they had tournaments running all day long. They were just 3-question tournaments, and the object was to beat James Holzhauer. And I stood in line, and it was actually James Holzhauer. It was not a faked picture by any means. And it was of the 3 questions, all 3 were either about sports or popular culture, which are terrible subjects for me. I did ring in on 1 question and just and guessed and got it wrong. And so, of course, I lost, but I'm really happy because for my name, I wrote down Wizard of Odds. And after the game, Holzhauer said to me, "Oh, are you with that website, Wizard of Odds?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, I founded that website." And he said, "I really like the feature where it shows which casino belongs to which family of sports books." And so I was really happy that he was at least familiar with my website. And I told him that I analyzed his final game to death, because so many people, there's a conspiracy theory out there that he threw that game, and it was a stupid decision for him to bet low. But I totally defend his decision to do that, and do to this day. So I don't know if he ever went and read what I wrote, but that was a lot of fun.
So, well, yeah. Well, a lot of us we were all used to him betting when he had an unbeatable position. Mm-hmm. But in that game, he was in second place and had to guard against whoever was in third. Mm-hmm. Because these days, second place gets, I think it's $2,000, and third place gets $1,000. So even though he had had so much money, it's still $1,000 he was guarding to protect. So mm-hmm. I thought he made absolutely the right.
Agreed.
And in addition, I remember when he was on our show and he said nice things about, he could have gone on Good Morning America or Gambling with an Edge, and he chose Gambling with an Edge. It's like, that made my year. there haven't been a whole lot of people on our show with whom I've been starstruck by being in the same room with, but he's one of them. And as near as I can tell, he's a really nice guy, and I'm glad to at least know him casually.
Yeah, I don't know him personally, but I do know people who play bridge with him, and everyone says he's a very nice guy, but also quite shy.
Yes. All right. We've been talking to Michael Shackelford, and at the end of the show, we come up with a recommended section where each of the hosts and sometimes our guest comes up with something they'd like to recommend to our readers. Richard, do you have something to recommend this week?
Yes, although it's I recommend to our listeners because I don't think a lot of people are reading our show. But anyway, my recommendation this week is a show called The Spy. It is on Netflix, and it's only, I think, 6 episodes. It's a true story of a guy named Eli Cohen, who was a spy for Israel in Syria back in the early 60s. And the lead, Eli Cohen, is played by Sacha Baron Cohen, who's known for his outrageous comedies like Borat. But he's actually quite a good actor. And so this is, if you like spy movies or that kind of stuff, I think you'll really like it. And the fact that it's a true story, I think, also makes it really interesting.
Very good. For my recommended, I want to actually give a partial recommendation. It's to the fifth episode in the Ringer series about gamblers. And the fifth episode was about poker player Phil Galfond. Now, the episode involves Galfond issuing an online challenge to everybody in the world for pot limit Omaha. And he gets way, way behind and makes a miraculous comeback. So this was somewhat riveting, but as a storyteller, I was disappointed in the way the story was told. You knew after 1 minute or 2 minutes into the show that there was going to be a miraculous ending to it. And so as you're listening to it, you're not really wondering what's going to happen because you know. And I, as a storyteller, I thought it could be told much better where you didn't know what the ending was until the ending. Now, those of you who listen to our show regularly, we had Matthew Dix on a few months ago, who is a storytelling guy. And so a lot of my ideas of what makes good storytelling come from Matthew Dix. And there's certainly a lot of different opinions as to how to do it. And of course, that's part of the ESPN network, and they're paid well to do that, so they have a right to have their own opinion on it. But I was disappointed in the way that story was told.
Okay, but I like to go. Sorry to interrupt you.
Go ahead, Michael. Do you have a recommended?
I do. Comment? I recommend the Netflix series The Queen's Gambit. This is a 7-episode miniseries that follows a chess player by the name of Beth Harmon. It takes place during the 1960s when there was a big chess fad and the Soviet Union was the big enemy in chess. And it starts out where she's a young girl in an orphanage and the maintenance man teaches her how to play chess and she becomes addicted to it and she's just a natural talent at it. And it follows her life from about the age of 6 into her, I guess, late 20s and her rise in the chess world. At the meantime, she's battling problems with addiction and other things, shall we say. But the actress who plays Beth Harmon is nice to look at, and I think that it's really well written, well acted, and I think your audience would like it, who I would like to think is an intelligent audience that is interested in game theory and things like that. So it definitely respects chess a lot. I hear that Kasparov was an advisor to the whole show and actually handpicked the moves for all the games in the show. So a big positive recommendation from me.
I just want to say I actually recommended it about a month ago. And one of the things I loved about it is usually when you see a game represented in a movie or television show, whether it's backgammon or chess or whatever, you take one look at the board and you go, well, that's ridiculous. Whereas here, they clearly, every time they showed the board, like they would talk about the Sicilian, they were clearly playing the Sicilian. So it was, really, really well done in that regard. Also, I just want to mention the show comes from a book by Walter Tevis, who wrote The Hustler. And so you might want to check out the novel as well.
Very good. So thank you again, Michael Shackelford, for coming on. Thank you, Richard. And go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.